And now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hi, I'm Bill McDermott. Today I'll be reading from the book Blue Moose by Manus Pinkwater. Chapter 1, Moose Meeting. Mr. Breton had a little restaurant on the edge of the big woods. There was nothing north of Mr. Breton's house except nothing, with trees in between. When winter came, the north wind blew through the trees and froze everything solid, and then it would snow. Mr. Breton didn't like it. Mr. Breton was a very good cook. Every day, people from the town came to his restaurant. They ate gallons of his special clam chowder. They ate plates of his special beef stew. They ate fish stew and Mr. Breton's special homemade bread. The people from the town never talked much, and they never said anything about his cooking. "Do you like your clam chowder?" Mr. Breton would ask. Yep, the people from town would say. Mr. Breton wished they would say, "Delicious," or "Good chowder, Breton." All they ever said was, yep. In winter, they came on skis and snowshoes. Every morning, Mr. Breton went out behind his house to get firewood. He wore three sweaters, a scarf, galoshes, a woolen hat, a big checkered coat, and mittens. He still felt cold. Sometimes animals came out of the woods to watch Mr. Breton. Raccoons and rabbits came. The cold didn't bother them. It bothered Mr. Breton even more when they watched him. One morning, there was a moose in Mr. Breton's yard. It was a blue moose. When Mr. Breton went out his back door, the moose was there, looking at him. After a while, Mr. Breton went back in, closed the door, and made a pot of coffee while he waited for the moose to go away. It didn't go away. It just stood in Mr. Breton's yard, looking at his back door. Mr. Breton drank a cup of coffee. The moose stood in the yard. Mr. Breton opened the door again. "Shoo! Go away," he said. "Do you mind if I come in and get warm?" the moose said. "I'm just about frozen." The moose brushed past him and walked into the kitchen. His antlers almost touched the ceiling. The moose sat down on the floor next to Mr. Breton's stove. He closed his eyes and sat leaning toward the stove for a long time. Mr. Breton stood in the kitchen looking at the moose. The moose didn't move. Wisps of steam began to rise from his blue fur. After a long time, the moose sighed. It sounded like a foghorn. "Can I get you a cup of coffee?" Mr. Breton asked the moose. "Or some clam chowder?" "Clam chowder," said the moose. Mr. Breton filled a bowl with creamy clam chowder and set it on the floor. The moose dipped his big nose into the bowl and snuffled up the chowder. He made a sort of slurping, whistling noise. "Sir," the moose said, "this is wonderful clam chowder." Mr. Breton blushed a very deep red. "Do you really mean that?" "Sir," the moose said, "I've eaten some very good chowder in my time, and yours is the very best." "Oh, my," said Mr. Breton, blushing even redder. "Oh, my. Would you like some more?" "Yes, with crackers," said the moose. The moose ate 17 bowls of chowder with crackers. Then he had 12 pieces of hot gingerbread and 48 cups of coffee. While the moose slurped and whistled, Mr. Breton sat in a chair. Every now and then he said to himself, "Oh my, the best he's ever eaten. Oh my." Later, when some people from the town came to Mr. Breton's house, the moose met them at the door. "How many in your party, please?" the moose asked. "I have a table for you. Please follow me." The people from the town were surprised to see the moose. They felt like running away, but they were too surprised. The moose led them to a table, brought them menus, looked at each person, snorted, and clumped into the kitchen. "There are some people outside. I'll take care of them," he told Mr. Breton. The people were whispering to one another about the moose when he clumped back to the table. "Are you ready to order?" Yep, the people from town said. They waited for the moose to ask them if they would like some chowder, the way Mr. Breton always did. But the moose just stared at them as though they were very foolish. The people felt uncomfortable. "We'll have the clam chowder." "Chowder de clam, very good," the moose said. "Do you desire crackers or homemade bread?" "We will have the crackers," said the people from the town. "I suggest you have the bread. It's hot," said the moose. We will have the bread, said the people from the town. And for dessert, said the moose, will you have fresh gingerbread or apple jacquette? What do you recommend, asked the people from the town. After the chaudière de clam, the gingerbread is best. Thank you, said the people from the town. It's my pleasure to serve you, said the moose. The moose brought bowls of chowder balanced on his antlers. At the end of the meal, the moose clumped up to the table. Has everything been to your satisfaction, he asked. Yep, said the people from the town, their mouths full of gingerbread. I beg your pardon, said the moose. What did you say? It was very good, said the people from the town. It was the best we've ever eaten. I will tell the chef, said the moose. The moose clumped into the kitchen and told Mr. Breton that the people from the town had said that the food was the best they had ever eaten. Mr. Breton rushed out of the kitchen and out of the house. The people from the town were sitting on the porch, putting on their snowshoes. Did you tell the moose that my clam chowder was the best you'd ever eaten? Mr. Breton asked. Yep, said the people from the town. We said that. We think that you're the best cook in the world. We've always thought so. Always? Asked Mr. Breton. Of course, the people from the town said. Why do you think we walk 7 miles on snowshoes just to eat here? The people from the town walked away on their snowshoes. Mr. Breton sat on the edge of the porch and thought it over. When the moose came out to see why Mr. Breton was sitting outside without his coat on, Mr. Breton said, Do you know, those people think I'm the best cook in the world. Of course they do, the moose said. Do you want me to go into town to get some crackers? We seem to have run out. Yes, said Mr. Breton, and get some asparagus, too. I'm going to cook something special tomorrow. By the way, said the moose, aren't you cold out here? No, I'm not in the least bit cold, Mr. Breton said. This is turning out to be a very mild winter. Chapter 2, Game Warden. There was a lot of talk in town about the moose at Mr. Breton's restaurant. Some people who had never been there before went to the restaurant just to see the moose. There was an article in the newspaper about the moose and how he talked to the customers and brought them their bowls of clam chowder and helped Mr. Breton in the kitchen. Some people from other towns drove a long way with chains on their tires to Mr. Breton's restaurant just to see the moose. Mr. Breton was always very busy waiting on tables at lunchtime and supper time. The moose was always very polite to the people, but he made them feel a little uncomfortable too. He looked at people with only one eye at a time, and he was better than most of them at pronouncing French words. He knew what kind of wine to drink with clam chowder, and he knew what kind of wine to drink with a special beef stew. Some of the people in town bragged that the moose was a friend of theirs and always gave them a table right away. When they came to the restaurant, they would pat the moose on the back and say, Hello, moose, you remember me, don't you? There will be a slight delay until a table is ready, the moose would say and snort and shake himself. Mr. Breton was very happy in the kitchen. There were pots of all sorts of good things steaming on the stove and smelling good and bread baking in the oven from morning to night. Mr. Breton loved to cook good things for lots of people, the more the better. He had never been so busy and happy in his life. One morning, Mr. Bobovitz, the game warden, came to the restaurant. Mr. Breton, are you aware of Section 5, Subheading 6, Paragraph 3 of the State Fish and Game Laws? Said Mr. Bobovitz. No, I'm not aware of Section 5, Subheading 6, Paragraph 3, Mr. Breton said. What is it all about? No person shall keep a moose as a pet, tie up a moose, keep a moose in a pen or a barn or parlor or bedroom or in any such closure, said Mr. Bobovitz. In short, it's against the law to have a tame moose. Oh my, said Mr. Breton. I don't want to do anything against the law, but I don't keep the moose. He just came along one day and has stayed ever since. He helps me run my restaurant. Mr. Bobovitz rubbed his chin. And where is the aforesaid moose? Mr. Breton had given the moose one of his rooms upstairs in which there was a particularly large bed. The moose just fit in the bed if he folded up his feet. He liked it very much. He said he'd never had a bed of his own. The moose slept on the bed under 6 blankets, and during the day he would go upstairs sometimes and stretch out on the bed and sigh with pleasure. When Mr. Bobovitz came to see Mr. Breton, the moose had been downstairs to help Mr. Breton eat a giant breakfast. And then he'd wandered back to his room to enjoy lying on his bed until the lunchtime customers arrived. He heard Mr. Breton and Mr. Bobovitz talking. The moose bugled. He'd never bugled in Mr. Breton's house before. Bugling is a noise that no animal except a moose can really do right. Elk can bugle, elephants can bugle, and some kinds of geese and swans can bugle, but it's nothing like moose bugling. When the moose bugled, the whole house jumped and rattled, dishes clinked together in the cupboard, pots and pans clanged together, icicles fell off the house. "I am not a tame moose," the moose shouted from where he was lying in the bed. Mr. Bobovitz looked at Mr. Breton with very wide eyes. Was that the moose? The moose had gotten out of bed and was clumping down the stairs. "You're flipping right. That was the moose," he growled. The moose clumped right up to Mr. Bobovitz and looked at him with one red eye. The moose's nose was touching Mr. Bobovitz's nose. They just stood there looking at each other for a long time. The moose was breathing loudly, and his eyes seemed to be a glowing coal. Mr. Bobovitz's knees were shaking. Then the moose spoke very slowly. "You are a tame game warden." The moose turned and clumped back up the stairs. Mr. Breton and Mr. Bobovitz heard him sigh and heard the springs crash and groan as he flopped onto the big bed. "Mr. Bobovitz, the moose is not tame," Mr. Breton said. "He's a wild moose, and he lives here of his own free will. He is the head waiter." Mr. Breton spoke very quietly because Mr. Bobovitz had not moved since the moose had come downstairs. His eyes were still open very wide, and his knees were still shaking. Mr. Breton took Mr. Bobovitz by the hand and led him into the kitchen and poured him a cup of coffee. Chapter 3, Days. Not very far from Mr. Breton's house, in a secret place in the woods, lived a hermit named Dave. Everybody knew that Dave was out there, but nobody ever saw him. Mr. Bobovitz, the game warden, had seen what might have been Dave a couple of times, or it might have been a shadow. Sometimes, late at night, Mr. Breton would hear the wind whistling strangely and think of Dave. The moose brought Dave home with him one night. They were old friends. Dave was dressed in rabbit skin stitched together. His feet were wrapped in tree bark and moose moss. An owl sat on his head. "Dave is very shy," the moose said. "He would appreciate it if you didn't say anything to him until he knows you better, maybe in 10 or 15 years. He knows about your gingerbread, and he would like to try it." While the moose spoke, Dave blushed very red and tried to cover his face with the owl, which fluttered and squawked. Mr. Breton put dishes with gingerbread and applesauce and fresh whipped cream in front of Dave, the moose, and the owl. There was no noise but the moose slurping and Dave's spoon scraping. Mr. Breton turned to get the coffee pot. When he looked back at the table, Dave and the owl were gone. "Dave says thank you," the moose said. The next night, Dave was back, and this time he had a whistle made of a turkey bone in his hat. After the gingerbread, Dave played on the whistle, like the wind making strange sounds. The moose hummed, and Mr. Breton clicked two spoons while the owl hopped up and down on the kitchen table, far into the night. Chapter 4, Hums of a Moose. One day, after the moose had been staying with Mr. Breton for a fairly long time, there was an especially heavy snowfall. The snow got to be as high as the house, and there was no way for people to come from the town. Mr. Breton got a big fire going in the stove and kept adding pieces of wood until the stove was glowing red. The house was warm and filled with the smell of applesauce, which Mr. Breton was cooking in big pots on the stove. Mr. Breton was peeling apples and the moose was sitting on the floor, lapping every now and then at a big chowder bowl full of coffee on the kitchen table. The moose didn't say anything. Mr. Breton didn't say anything. Now and then the moose would take a deep breath with his nose in the air, sniffing in the smell of apples and cinnamon and raisins cooking. Then he would sigh. The sighs got louder and longer. The moose began to hum, softly, then louder. The humming made the table shake, and Mr. Breton felt the humming in his fingers each time he picked up an apple. The humming mixed with the apple and cinnamon smell and melted the frost on the windows, and the room filled with sunlight. Mr. Breton smelled flowers. Then he could see them. The kitchen floor had turned into a meadow with new grass, dandelions, periwinkles, and daisies. The moose hummed. Mr. Breton smelled melting snow. He heard ice cracking. He felt the ground shake under the hooves of moose returning from the low wet places. Rabbits bounded through the fields. Bears, thin after the winter's sleep, came out of hiding. Birds sang. The people in the town could not remember such an unseasonable thaw. The weather got warm all of a sudden, and the ice and snow melted for 4 days before winter set in again. When they went to Mr. Breton's restaurant, they discovered that he had made a wonderful stew with lots of carrots that reminded them of meadows in the springtime. Chapter 5, Moose Moving. When spring finally came, the moose became moody. He spent a lot of time staring out the back door. Flocks of geese flew overhead, returning to lakes in the north, and the moose always stirred when he heard their honking. "Chef," the moose said one morning, "I will be going tomorrow. I wonder if you would pack some gingerbread for me to take along." Mr. Breton baked a special batch of gingerbread and packed it in parcels tied with strings so the moose could hang them from his antlers. When the moose came downstairs, Mr. Breton was sitting in the kitchen drinking coffee. The parcels of gingerbread were on the kitchen table. "Do you want a bowl of coffee before you go?" Mr. Breton asked. "Thank you," said the moose. "I shall certainly miss you," Mr. Breton said. "Thank you," said the moose. "You're the best friend I have," said Mr. Breton. "Thank you," said the moose. "Do you suppose you'll ever come back?" Mr. Breton asked. "Not before Thursday or Friday," said the moose. "It would be impolite to visit my uncle for less than a week." The moose hooked his antlers into the loops of string on the packages of gingerbread. "My uncle will like this." He stood up and turned to the door. "Wait," Mr. Breton shouted. "Do you mean that you're not leaving forever? I thought you were lonely for the life of a wild moose. I thought you wanted to go back to the wild, free places." "Jeff, do you have any idea how cold it gets in the wild, free places?" the moose said. "And the food, terrible." "Have a nice time at your uncle's," said Mr. Breton. "I'll send you a postcard," said the moose. You've been listening to a story from the book Blue Moose by Manus Pinkwater, published by Dodd, Mead & Company of New York. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. Our engineer is Robert Gilfillan. The executive producer is Carlos Canella, and I'm Bill McDermott.
And now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hello, I'm June Connell Stevens. Today I'll be reading poems from the book Straight On Till Morning, selected by Helen Hill, Skin Spinners by Joan Eichen, and Amelia Mix the Mustard, compiled by Evelyn Ness. From Straight On Till Morning, Poems of the Imaginary World. Knoxville, Tennessee, by Nikki Giovanni. I always liked summer best. You can eat fresh corn from Daddy's garden, and okra, and greens, and cabbage, and lots of barbecue, and buttermilk, and homemade ice cream at the church picnic, and listen to gospel music outside at the church homecoming, and go to the mountains with your grandmother, and go barefooted, and be warm all the time. Not only when you go to bed and sleep. I Had to Be Secret by Mark Van Doren. I hid the peppermint under my pillow in Grandmother's house at the top of the stairs. She wouldn't have minded, but so I did. I had to be secret, for who would have known I was not as I seemed? I was double of heart. I was angel and devil on different days. And who could have seen so deep into me as to say any moment which was which? The Paint Box by E.V. Rue. Cobalt and umber and ultramarine, ivory black and emerald green, what shall I paint to give pleasure to you? Paint for me somebody utterly new. I have painted you tigers in crimson and white. The colors were good, and you painted aright. I have painted the cook and the camel in blue, and a panther in purple. You painted them true. Now mix me a color that nobody knows, and paint me a country where nobody goes, and put in it people a little like you, watching a unicorn drinking the dew. The Lady and the Bear by Theodore Refke. A lady came to a bear by a stream. Oh, why are you fishing that way? Tell me, dear bear, there by the stream, why are you fishing that way? I am what is known as a biddly bear. That's why I'm fishing this way. We biddlies are peculiar bears, and so I'm fishing this way. And besides, it seems there's a law, a most exactious law, that a bear doesn't dare use a hook or a line or an old piece of twine, not even the end of his claw, not even the end of his claw. Yes, a bear has to fish with his paw. A bear has to fish with his paw. Oh, it's wonderful how with the flick of your wrist you can fish out a fish. If I were a fish, I just couldn't resist you when you are fishing that way, when you are fishing that way. And at that, the lady slipped from the bank and fell in the stream, still clutching a plank. But the bear just sat there until she sank. As he went on fishing his way, as he went on fishing his way. Mother to Son by Langston Hughes. Well, son, I'll tell you, life for me ain't been no crystal stair. It's had cracks in it, and splinters, and boards torn up, places with no carpet on the floor, bare. But all the time I've been climbing on, and reaching landings and turning corners, and sometimes going in the dark where there ain't been no light. So, boy, don't you turn back. Don't you set down on the steps because you find it kind of hard. Don't you fall now, for I'm still going, honey. I'm still climbing, and life for me ain't been no crystal stair. From The Skin Spinners by Joan Eichen. Handover. It would be funny if we didn't have money. How would we work out a price? One cat is better than 20 mice. How would we tot up cost? A vacuum cleaner is worth a ton of dust. How to assess value? A dozen sparrows equal one curlew. How decide worth? One rose to an acre of earth. How figure expense? A mad bull is worth a strong fence. How fix a reasonable charge? A good poem is worth a bit of bread and marge. What would we call cheap? A hurricane for a night's sleep. And dear? A lump of coal for a miner's fear. Charter flight. What did the captain say when you took him a cup of tea? He said there were hundreds of icebergs as far as the eye could see, and the sound of seals barking was the most forlorn and doleful cry in all that ice. And the northern lights, red and green, were like a fire opal in the sky. Everything in the northern world was hard and bright, he said. It was like flying over a jeweled crown on someone's head, the stars flashing sharper than headlights above, while low and dim, the midnight sun shone, a great smoky ruby on the world's rim. The captain comes back to the airport all dislocated and wanders about the whole day in a daze, instead of sensibly going to bed. It's a good thing his route is over the North Pole, not the South, or as likely as not, he'd pass the time between trips just standing on his head. From Amelia Mix the Mustard, selected by Evelyn Ness. If No One Ever Marries Me by Lawrence Alma Tadema. If no one ever marries me, and I don't see why they should, for Nurse says I'm not pretty and I'm seldom very good, if no one ever marries me, I shan't mind very much. I shall buy a squirrel in a cage and a little rabbit hut. I shall have a cottage near a wood, and a pony all my own, and a little lamb quite clean and tame that I can take to town. And when I'm getting really old, at 28 or 29, I shall buy a little orphan girl and bring her up as mine. Pandora by Myra Cone Livingston. There's this thing about Pandora's box, this wondering, this curiosity. There it was, this box, not locked or anything. And Pandora was bored. You've heard the rest. She opened it. Out came everything bad. Evil, famine, crime, war, greed, and a great black cloud. The only joker in the lot was Hope. Girls' Names by Eleanor Farjon. What lovely names for girls there are. There's Stella like the evening star, and Sylvia like a rustling tree, and Lola like a melody, and Flora like a flowery morn, and Sheila like a field of corn, and Melusina like the moan of water, and there's Joan like Joan. Adventures of Isabel by Ogden Nash. Isabel met an enormous bear. Isabel didn't care. The bear was hungry. The bear was ravenous. The bear's big mouth was cruel and cavernous. The bear said, "Isabel, glad to meet you. How do, Isabel? Now I'll eat you." Isabel didn't worry. Isabel didn't scream or scurry. She washed her hands and she straightened her hair up. Then Isabel quietly ate the bear up. Once in a night as black as pitch, Isabel met a wicked old witch. The witch's face was cross and wrinkled. The witch's gums with teeth were sprinkled. "Ho, ho, Isabel," the old witch crowed, "I'll turn you into an ugly toad." Isabel didn't worry. Isabel didn't scream or scurry. She showed no rage and she showed no rancor, but she turned the witch into milk and drank her. Rebecca, Who Slammed Doors for Fun and Perished Miserably by Hilaire Belloc. A trick that everyone abhors in little girls is slamming doors. A wealthy banker's little daughter, who lived in Palace Green, Bayswater, by name Rebecca Offendort, was given to this furious sport. She would deliberately go and slam the door like Billy Ho, to make her Uncle Jacob start. She was not really bad at heart, but only rather rude and wild. She was an aggravating child. It happened that a marble bust of Abraham was standing just above the door this little lamb had carefully prepared to slam, and down it came. It knocked her flat. It laid her out. She looked like that. Her funeral sermon, which was long and followed by a sacred song, mentioned her virtues, it is true, but dwelt upon her vices, too, and showed the dreadful end of one who goes and slams the door for fun. I Am Rose by Gertrude Stein. I am Rose, my eyes are blue. I am Rose, and who are you? I am Rose, and when I sing, I am Rose like anything. Poem for Flora by Nikki Giovanni. When she was little and colored and ugly with short straightened hair and a very pretty smile, she went to Sunday school to hear about Nebuchadnezzar, the king of the Jews. And she would listen, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fire. And she would learn how God was neither north nor south, east or west, with no color, but all she remembered was that Sheba was black and comely, and she would think, I want to be like that. Abigail by Kay Starbird. Abigail knew when she was born, among the roses, she was a thorn. Her quiet mother had lovely looks. Her quiet father wrote quiet books. Her quiet brothers, correct though pale, weren't really prepared for Abigail, who entered the house with howls and tears, while both of her brothers blocked their ears, and both of her parents, talking low, said, "Why is Abigail screaming so?" Abigail kept on getting worse. As soon as she teased, she bit her nurse. At 3, she acted distinctly cool toward people and things at nursery school. "I'm sick of cutting out dolls," she said. She cut a hole in her dress instead. Her mother murmured, "She's bold for 3. Her father answered, "I quite agree." Her brothers mumbled, "We hate to fuss, but when will Abigail be like us?" Abigail, going through her teens, liked overalls and pets and machines. In college, hating most of its teachers, she told off all of her friends and teachers. Her brothers, graduating from Yale, said, "Really, you're hopeless, Abigail." And while her mother said, "Fix your looks," her father added, "Or else write books." And Abigail asked, "Is that a dare?" and wrote a book that would curl your hair. You've been listening to poems from the book Straight On Till Morning, selected by Helen Hill, published by Thomas Crowell Company, Skin Spinners by Joan Eichen, published by Viking Press, and Amelia Makes the Mustard, compiled by Evelyn Ness and published by Charles Scribner's. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. Our engineer is Robert Gilfillan. The executive producer is Carla Canella. And I'm June Canell Stevens.
And now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hello, I'm Dan Gorman.
And I'm Barbara Gorman.
Today we'll be reading from the book, The Princesses, 16 Stories About Princesses, selected by Sally Peck Johnson. Today's story is The Princess and the Vagabond, collected by Ruth Sawyer. Once in a golden time, when an Irish king sat in every province and plenty covered the land, there lived in Connaught a grand old king with one daughter. She was tall and slender as the reeds that grew by Loch Earn, and her face was the fairest in 7 counties. This was more the pity, for the temper she had did not match it at all. It was the blackest and ugliest that ever fell to the birth lot of a princess. She was proud, she was haughty, her tongue had the length and the sharpness of the thorns of a sea dog bush, and from the day she was born to long after she was a woman grown, she was never heard to say a kind word or known to do a kind deed to a living creature. As each year passed, the king would think to himself, "What if the new year will see her better?" But it was worse instead of better she grew, until one day the king found himself at the end of his patience. "Faith, another man shall have her for the next 18 years, for by my soul, I've had my fill of her." So it came about, as I'm telling you, that the king sent word to the nobles of the neighboring provinces that whosoever should win the consent of his daughter in marriage should have half his kingdom and the whole of his blessing. On the day that she was 18, a wonderful procession of earls, dukes, and princes and kings came riding up to the castle gate a-courting. The king made each one welcome according to his rank, and then he sent a serving man to his daughter bidding it to come and choose her suitor, the time being right for her to marry. It was a courteous message that the king sent, but the princess heard little of it. She flew into the hall on the heels of the serving men like a foul hawk after a bantam cock. Her eyes burned with the anger that was hot in her heart, so she stamped her foot in the king's face until the rafters rang with the noise of it.
Oh, you'll be giving me away for the asking to any one of these blithering fools who has a rag to his back or a castle to his name.
The king grew crimson at her words. He was ashamed that they should all hear how sharp was her tongue. Moreover, he was fearsome lest they should take to their heels and leave him with a shrew in his hands for another 18 years. He was hard at work piecing together a speech when the princess strode past him on to the first suitor in the line.
At any rate, I'll not be choosing you long-legged corn crake.
And she gave him a sound kick as she went on to the next. He was a large man with a shaggy beard, and seeing how the first suitor had fared, he tried a wee bit of a smile on her while his hand went out coaxingly. She saw, and the anger in her grew threefold. She sprang at him, digging the two of her hands deep in his beard, and then she wagged his foolish head back and forth, screaming,
"Take that and that and that, ye old whiskered rascal!"
It was a miracle that any beard was left on his face the way that she pulled it. But she left him go free at last, and turned to a thin, sharp-faced prince with a monstrous long nose. The nose took her fancy, and she gave it a tweak, telling the prince to take himself home before he did any damage with it. The next one she called Pudding Face, and slapped his fat cheeks until they were purple, and the poor lad groaned with the sting of it. She moved swiftly down the line in less time than it takes for the telling. It came to the mind of many of the suitors that they would be doing a wise thing if they betook themselves off before their turn came. As many of them were not fastened to the floor with fear, started away. There happened to be a fat, crooked-legged prince from Leinster, just making for the door when the princess looked around. In a trice she reached out for the tongs that stood on the hearth nearby, and she laid them across his shoulders, sending him spinning into the yard.
"Take that, ye old gander, and good riddance to ya!"
It was then that she saw looking at her a great, towering giant of a man, and his eyes burned through hers, deep down into her soul. So great was he that he could have picked her up and with a single hand and thrown her after the gander, and she knew it, and yet she felt no fear. She was as handsome as Nuada of the Silver Hand, and not a mortal fault could she have found with him. The two of them stood facing each other, glaring, as if each would spring at the other's throat the next moment. But all the while, the princess was thinking, and thinking how wonderful he was, from the top of his curling black hair down the 7 feet of him to the golden clasp on his shoes. What the man was thinking, I cannot be telling. Like a breath of wind on smoldering turf, her liking for him set her anger fierce burning again. She gave him a sound cuff on the ear, and then turned, and with a sob in her throat, she went flying from the room, the serving men scattering before her as if she'd been 100 million robbers on a raid. And the king? Faith, he was dumb with rage, but when he saw the blow that his daughter had given to the finest gentleman in all of Ireland, he went after her as if he had been 200 million constables on the trail of the robbers. "You're a disgrace and a shame to me," said he, catching up with her and holding firmly to her two hands. "And what's more, you're a disgrace and a blemish to my castle and my kingdom, and I'll not keep you in it a day longer. The first traveling vagabond who comes begging at the door shall have you for his wife."
"Will he?"
And the princess tossed her head in the king's face and went into his tent. The next morning, a poor singing minstrel came to the castle to sell a song for a penny or a morsel of bread. The song was sweet that he sang, and the princess listened as Una, the tire woman, was winding strands of her long black hair with golden thread. The gay young wren sang o'er the moor. "I'll build me a nest," sang he. "'Twill have a thatch and a wee latch door, for the wind blows cold from the sea. And I'll let no one but my true love in, for she is the mate for me," sang the gay young wren. The wee brown wren by the hedgerow cried, I'll wait for him here, cried she, for the way is far and the world is wide, and he might miss the way to me. Long is the time when the heart is shut, but I'll open to none save he, sang the wee brown wren. A strange throb came to the heart of the princess when the song was done. She pulled her hair free from the hands of the tire woman.
Get silver, I would throw it to him.
And when she saw the wonderment grow in Una's face, she added,
Would the song please me? Can I not pay for what I like without having you look at me as if it feared my wits had flown? Go, get the silver.
But when she pushed open the grating and leaned far out to throw it, the minstrel had gone. For the king had heard the song as well as the princess. His rage was still with him, and when he saw who it was, he lost no time, but called him quickly inside. You're as fine a vagabond as I could wish for, he said. Maybe you're not knowing it, but you're a bridegroom this day. And the king went on to tell him the whole tale. The tale being finished, he sent 10 strong men to bring the princess down. Now, king's word was law in those days. The vagabond knew this, and what's more, he knew he must marry the princess whether he liked it or no. The vagabond had great height, but he stooped so that it shortened the length of him. His hair was long, and it fell uncombed and matted about his shoulders. His brogues were patched, his hose were sadly worn, and with his rags, he was the sorriest cut of a man that a maid had ever laid her two eyes on. When the princess came, she was dressed in a gown of gold with jewels hanging from every thread of it, and her cap was caught with a jeweled brooch. She looked as beautiful as a May morning, with a thundercloud rising back of the hills, and the vagabond held his breath for a moment, watching her. Then he pulled the king gently by the arm. I'll not have a wife that looks grander than myself. If I marry your daughter, I must marry her in rags, the same as my own. The king agreed it was a good idea, and sent for the worst dress of rags in the whole countryside. The rags were fetched, the princess dressed, and the priest brought, and the two of them married, and though she cried, and she kicked, and she cuffed, and she prayed, she was the vagabond's wife, hard and fast. Now take her, and good luck go with you, said the king. Then his eyes fell on the tongs by the hearth. Here, take these along, they may come in handy on the road. Out of the castle gate, across the gardens, and into the country that lay beyond, went the princess and the vagabond. The sky was blue over their heads, and the air was full of spring. Each wee creature that passed them on the road seemed bursting with the very joy of it. There was naught but anger in the princess's heart, however, and that in the heart of the, what was in the heart of the vagabond, I cannot be telling. This I know, that he sang the song of the wren as they went. Oh, often, the princess turned back on the road, or sat down, swearing she would go no further. And often, did she feel the weight of the tongs across her shoulder that day. At noon, the two sat down by the crossroads to rest.
I'm hungry. Not a morsel of food have I tasted this day. You will go and get me some.
Not I, my dear. You will go and beg for yourself.
Never.
Then you'll go hungry, said the vagabond. And that was all. He lighted his pipe, and he went to sleep with one eye open and the tongs under him. 1, 2, 3 hours passed, and the sun hung low in the sky. The princess sat there until hunger drove her to her feet. She rose wearily and stumbled to the road. It might have been the sound of wheels that had started her. I cannot be telling. But as she reached the road, a great coach, drawn by 6 black horses, came galloping up. The princess made a sign for it to stop. Though she was in rags, yet she was still so beautiful that the coachman drew in the horses and asked her what she was wanting.
I am near to starving.
And as she spoke, the tears started to her eyes, while a new soft note crept into her voice.
Do you think your master could spare me a bit of food or a shilling?
And the hand that had been used to strike went out for the first time to beg. It was a prince who rode inside the coach that day, and he heard her, Reaching out a fine big hamper through the window, he told her she was hearty welcome to whatever she found in it, along with his blessing. But as she put up her arms for it, just, she looked and saw the prince was none other than the fat suitor whose face she had slapped on the day before. Then the anger came back to her again for the shame of begging from him. She emptied the hammer, chicken pasty, jam, currant bread, and all on top of his head, peering through the window and through the empty basket at the coachman. Away drove the coach. Away ran the princess and threw herself, sobbing on the ground, near the vagabond. "'Twas a good dinner that you lost," said the vagabond, and that was all. That night, they reached a wee scrap of a cabin on the side of a hill. The vagabond climbed the steps and opened the door. "Here you are at home, my dear."
"What kind of a home do you call this?"
And the princess stamped her foot.
"Faith, I'll not live in it."
"Ah, then you can live outside. It's all the same to me." The vagabond went in and closed the door after him. And in a moment, he was whistling merrily the song of the wee brown wren. The princess sat on the ground and nursed her poor tired knees. She had walked many a mile that day with a heavy heart and an empty stomach, two of the worst traveling companions you can find. The night came down black as a raven's wing. The dew fell heavy as rain, wetting the rags and chilling the princess to the marrow. The wind blew fresh from the sea, and the wolves began their howling in the woods nearby, and at last, what with the cold and the fear and the loneliness of it, she could bear it no longer, and she crept softly up to the cabin and went in. "Ah, there's the creepy stool by the fire waiting for you," said the vagabond, and that was all. But late in the night, he lifted her from the chimney corner where she had dropped asleep and laid her gently on the bed, which was freshly made and clean. And then he sat by the hearth until dawn, keeping the turf piled high on the fire so that cold would not waken her. Once he left the hearth, coming to the bedside, he stood a moment to watch her while she slept. And he stooped and kissed the wee pink palm of her hand that they lay there like a half-closed locket. Next morning, the first thing the princess asked was where was the breakfast, and where were the servants to wait on her, and where were some decent clothes? "Your servants are your own two hands, and they will serve you well when you teach them how," was the answer she got.
"I'll have neither breakfast nor clothes if I have to be getting them myself. And shame on you for treating your wife so."
And the princess caught up a piggin and threw it at the vagabond. Well, he jumped clear of it, and it struck the wall behind him. "Have your own way, my dear." And he left her to go out on the bog and cut turf. That night, the princess hung the kittle and made stirabout and griddle bread for the two of them. "Ah, 'tis the best I've tasted since I was a lad, and my mother made the bacon," said the vagabond. And that was all. But often and often, his lips touched the braids of her hair as she passed him in the dark. And again, he sat through the night, keeping the fire and mending her wee leather brogue that they might be whole against tomorrow. Next day, he brought some sally twigs and showed her how to weave them into creels to sell on the coming market day. But the twigs cut her fingers until they bled, and the princess cried, making the vagabond white with rage. Never had she seen such a rage in another creature. He threw the sally twigs about the cabin and stamped upon the half-made creel, crushing it to a pulp under his feet. And catching up the table, he tore it to splinters, throwing the fragments into the fire where they blazed. "By St. Patrick, 'tis a bad bargain that ye are. I will take you this day to the castle in the next county, where I hear they are needing a scullery maid, and there I'll apprentice you to the king's cook."
"I will not go."
But even as she spoke, fear showed in her eyes, and her knees began shaking under her. "Aye, but you will, my dear." And the vagabond took up the tongs quietly from the hearth. For a month, the princess worked in the castle of the king. And all that time she never saw the vagabond. Often and often she said to herself, fiercely, that she was well rid of him. But often, as she sat alone after her work in the cool of the night, she would wish for the song of the wee brown wren, while a new loneliness crept deeper and deeper into her heart. She worked hard about the kitchen, and as she scrubbed the pots and turned the spit and cleaned the floor with fresh white sand, she listened to the wonderful tales the other servants had to tell of the king. They had it that he was the handsomest, aye, and the strongest king in all of Ireland, and every man and child and little creature in his kingdom worshipped him. And after the tales were told, the princess would say to herself,
"If I had not been so proud and free with my tongue, I might have married such a king and ruled his kingdom with him, learning kindness."
Now it happened one day that the princess was told to be unusually spry and careful about her work. And there was a monstrous deal of it to be done. Cakes to be iced, puddings to be boiled, fat ducks to be roasted, and a whole suckling pig to be put on the spit to turn.
"What's the meaning of all this?"
"A cone, you poor feeble-minded girl." And the cook looked at her pityingly. "Haven't you heard the king is to be married this day to the fairest princess in 7 counties?
"Once that was I,"
thought the princess, and she sighed. "What makes you sigh?" asked the cook.
"I was wishing just that I could be having a peep at her and the king."
"Faith, that's possible. Do your work well, and maybe I can put you where you can see without being seen." So it came about, as I'm telling you, at the end of the day, when the feast was ready and the guests came, that the princess was hidden behind the broidered curtains in the great hall. There, where no one could see her, she watched the hundreds upon hundreds of fair ladies and fine noblemen in their silken dresses and shining coats. Then the pipers began to play, and everybody was still. From the furthest end of the hall came 22 lads in white and gold, and these were followed by 22 pipers in green and gold, and 22 bowmen in saffron and gold, and last of all, the king. A scream, a wee wisp of a cry, broke from the princess, and she would have fallen had she not caught hold of one of the curtains. For the king was tall and strong and beautiful as Nuada of the Silver Hand, and from the top of his curling black hair down the 7 feet of him to the golden clasp on his shoes, he was every whit as handsome as he had been that day when she had cuffed him in her father's castle. The king heard the cry and stopped the piper. "I think there's a scullery maid behind the curtains. Someone fetch her to me." 100 hands pulled the princess out. 100 more pushed her across the hall to the feet of the king and held her there, fearing lest she escape. "What were you doing there?"
"Looking at you and wishing I had the undoing of things I've done."
And the princess hung her head and sobbed piteously. "Ah, nay, sweetheart, things are best as they are." And there came a look into the king's eyes that blinded those watching, so that they turned away and left the two alone. "Heart of mine, are you not knowing me?"
"You're putting more shame on me because of my evil tongue and the blow my hand gave you that day."
"Faith, it's not so. Look at me." Slowly, the eyes of the princess looked into the eyes of the king. For a moment, she could not be reading him. She was as a child who pores over a strange tale after the light fades and it's grown too dark to see. But bit by bit, the meaning of it came to her, and her heart grew glad with the wonder of it. Out went her arms to him, and with a cry of loneliness that had been hers so long,
"I never dreamed that it was you. Never once."
"Can you ever love and forgive?"
"Hush, yes, hush."
And the princess laid her finger on his lips. The tire women were called, and she was led away. Her rags were changed for a dress that was spun from gold and woven with pearls, and her beauty shone about her like a great light. They were married again that night, for none of the guests were known of that first wedding long ago. Later that night, a singing minstrel came under the princess's window, and very softly the words of his song came to her. The gay young wren sang o'er the moor. "I'll build me a nest," sang he. "'Twill have a thatch and a wee latch door, for the wind blows cold from the sea.
and I'll let no one but my true love in, for she is the mate for me, sang the gay young wren. The wee brown wren by the hedgerow cried, I'll wait for him here, cried she, for the way is far and the world is wide, and he might miss the way to me. Long is the time when the heart is shut, but I'll open to none save thee, sang the wee brown wren. The grating opened slowly. The princess leaned far out, her eyes like stars in the night, and when she spoke, there was naught but gentleness and love in her voice.
Here is the silver I would have thrown you on a day long gone by. Shall I throw it now, or will ye come for it?
And that was how a princess of Connaught was won by a king who was a vagabond. You've been listening to a story from the book, The Princesses. 16 stories about princesses selected by Sally Patrick Johnson, published by Harper & Row, 1962. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Unaway. Our engineer is Robert Gilfillan. The executive producer is Carla Tonella. And I'm Dan Gorman.
And I'm Barbara Gorman.